Chapter 2. Silence's Shadow. Ash and Iron. Daggers Drawn. Bab Bastion, the Imperial Palace Terra. Silence flowed across Terra under the sound of sirens. It fell in the water markets of Albia as the shouting of buyer and seller faded and became looks held between strangers. It crept into the room where the cries of an hour's-old child echoed, as words of comfort died in a father's mouth. It followed the smoke, carrying the smell of the burning refuse from the spoil ranges. On the towers, watching the highways that ran to the feet of the Damocles spaceport, the soldiers ceased their pacing and looked up at the night sky. In cave shelters, billions of conscripts glanced at the roofs of rock before looking back down to the guns in their hands. They sat in loose groups, families, Hablock neighbours, manufactory shifts, saying nothing, waiting. In the administrative strata of the record hives, scribes moved between parchment spools and autoquills, following routine as though it would make a lie of the warning alarms. On the walls of the Imperial Palace, warriors watched the sunrise over the teeth of the eastern wall, and heard only the sound of the wind and the shrill of warning. Terra was a world waiting for the first blow to fall, and in the last inch of waiting, panic had found stillness. In the heart of the Grand Borealis Strategium in the Bab Bastion within the Imperial Palace, Admiral Su Kassen felt the silence crawl into the moments as she watched hollow projections of scrolling data. This was the primary command for the entire system, its view like that of a god looking down on a realm held in the light of the glowing displays. Primary fleet concentrations stood out as green runes, each a war command of tens of thousands of warships, monitor craft, and others that had been pressed into service.
"Update display. Primary fleet force readiness," she said.
She had repeated the command every 15 minutes for the last 6 hours.
"Compliance,"
droned a servitor. And the display stripped itself down to a few markers haloed with green data. The largest fleets held station beside Pluto, Uranus, Jupiter, Mars, and Terra. These were the 5-sphere commands. Signals took hours to pass from the throne world to the system edge, too long for the second-by-second control of battle. A Lord Castellan of the Imperial Fists commanded each layer of defence. Sigismund, Halbracht, Efried, Cambadaeus. Rogel Dorn commanded the 5th, final sphere around Terra. Other commands deferred to the Lord of the closest sphere. Troop concentrations were marked with coloured dots. The size of a force and its strength flickered around them in abbreviated code. The few legion units beyond the bounds of Terra glowed like hot coals, the other forces cold motes of fire. Amber specks marked fixed defences around planets or hanging in the gulfs between them. These were everything from void fortresses to shoals of gun platforms and space stations. Clouds of tiny blue spots folded through the spaces between the larger defences, indicating the vast clouds of mines, deadfall torpedoes, and proximity drones that had been cast amongst the dark like dust from a hand. Once the battle was done, the approaches to the inner system would be laced with death until the star itself died.
Once the battle was done,
if there was anything left besides ashes. Su Kassen shook herself. The first wall of any fortress was the mind, and doubt could burn it from within before the enemy had even raised a blade. She scanned the data again. It had not changed, of course. Out there in the heavens above, the fires of battle were already burning, but here the reality of that truth had yet to arrive.
"Report update!"
called a signal officer from behind a bank of machines.
"Show me," she said.
"By your will,"
said the officer. And she could hear the forced control in the man's voice. Machines clattered and whirred, stitching the silence as it stretched. The hollow display fuzzed, flickered, and then came into focus. She looked at the image and blinked. Crimson flecked the edge of the turning display. Her mind began to parse the marker runes and data abstractions. Strategic logic conditioning shunted aside thoughts as she absorbed the updated defense data. It was an odd sensation, one that she had never got used to in all the decades of her life and service. Every now and again, her thoughts and understanding would jump like a needle on a data cylinder, and she would find herself understanding something she had not an instant before. Bit by bit, the mass of runes and symbols resolved into meaning. "The Chthonic Gate," she thought.
"So it begins, just as we predicted and feared."
Starships had to translate from the warp at the edge of a system, beyond the Mandeville Point, that arcane and invisible line that marked the boundary between safety and suicide. Arrive inside that point, and the competing forces of reality and paradox would rip a vessel apart. Rebirth death, the navigators called it, when they talked of such things. Most established systems had navigation buoys and well-trodden points where it was safest to drop from the warp back into reality. Once back in the cold embrace of the void, ships then had to move in-system under the power of their real space engines. The journey from system edge to the planets of the core took even the fastest ships days. The solar system, though, was older than any colonized by humanity. Star travel and warp navigation had been birthed here, and over tens of thousands of years, more secrets, wonders, and terrors had been raised and lost within its bounds than existed in all the galaxy beyond. Two such relics of the past were the Twin Gates, stable points in space and the warp, where ships could translate safely. Both tracked the orbits of planets as they orbited Sol. The Chthonic Gate lay off Pluto, and the Elysian Gate lay close to Uranus. The latter offered a further layer of paradox, as it gave ships a way to re-enter deeper in the system, far beyond the point where they would be wrecked if they chanced it normally. Anyone who planned to attack Terra in force would want to secure the Twin Gates to move their forces into the solar system quickly. That Horus would pour everything he could into taking them was a certainty.
"That cannot be correct,"
croaked Kazim Aleph One, from where he hovered at her shoulder. The Magos emissary had only been attached to the command cadre for a week, and Su Kassen was still trying to understand him. He seemed logical and emphatic, but also hesitant, a combination she had never thought to see in someone who was so much more machine than flesh. His cranium whirred, cogs flipping around in slots that ran the length of his skull as the projection and screens updated.
"This is an error. This data indicates a warp reality translation via the Chthonic path of over 1,000 ships."
"More," she said quietly. "A lot more."
"That cannot be. It is an error. There is a Falcon fleet that can reach Pluto in 5 hours. They can—"
"No,"
she said, dropping her voice under the buzz of the machines.
"All other forces are to hold position, Magos emissary."
Even as she spoke, she felt the words pull against her instincts.
"Admiral,"
said the Magos,
"my calculations show that the Plutonic defenses can hold if reinforced. If the enemy has committed its main force strength to take Pluto as a bridgehead, and then can be held there—"
"They cannot be held," said a voice from across the chamber. "Not at a cost we can afford to pay."
Blast doors withdrew into the walls. Warriors in yellow armour and black cloaks poured in. Light caught the edges of ready weapons and sheened from armour plates. Threat radiated from them, sharper than their blades, roaring from their silence. And with them came the one who had spoken. Cold illumination struck the burnished gold of Rogel Dorn's armour, and lit fire in jewels clasped in the claws of eagles. Control radiated from him, vibrating through air and through light, the lightning promise at the edge of a storm. To the billions that lived on Terra, he was the wall against which the coming enemy would break, defiance and strength embodied. But in person he was not the idea that the desperate clung to as they thought of what was to come. He was a force of nature that moved and spoke,
A lightning bolt pulled from the sky and chained to flesh to fight until the universe broke him. The Imperial fists, standing vigil at the chamber edges, brought their clenched fists to their chests, but only Su Kassen bowed to the Praetorian as he advanced. The officers and adepts who served in the Bab Bastion were human for the most part. They were the finest war staff Su Kassen had ever seen, drawn from the old Solar military elite, war savants of the Saturnine Ordos, warriors of the Jovian Void clans, like her, tacticians from the Terran war courts. Every man and woman in the chamber knew their craft well enough to rival even the command skill of the legions, and all of them knew that when Rogel Dorn, Primarch of the 7th Legion and Praetorian of Terror, entered, they had a duty to continue in their tasks, rather than to bow. It had been Dorn's first order when he had created this command, Kada. Su Kassen saluted for all of them. But as the blast doors sealed again, she knew the presence of the three who walked with Dorn would test their obedience. Jagatai, Great Khan of the White Scars, walked on Dorn's left, his eyes dancing with the turning light of the hollow displays. On Dorn's other side came an angel, armoured in gold, white wings furled at his back. Sanguinius, Primarch of the 9th Legion, looked across the humans at their stations and then at Su Kassen. He smiled. Last of all came an old man in the grey robes of the Administratum, leaning on an eagle-topped staff. Wrinkled skin hung from his face, but his eyes were cold and bright. Malkador the Sigilite seemed older and weaker than Su Kassen had ever seen him. But it was he, as much as the three Primarchs, that made her hold her head bowed. The silence in the chamber deepened, seeming to press closer as the three loyal sons of the Emperor and his regent halted beneath the turning hollow display.
"The First Sphere forces cannot hold," said Dorn,
his dark eyes fixed on Kazim Aleph I,
"and it will not be reinforced."
The Major's emissary was still, the cogs protruding from his skull rotating slowly. For a second, Su Kassen thought he was going to argue. For a second, she hoped that he would.
"Lord Dorn, there are options,"
began Su Kassen, before she could stop herself.
"No,"
said Dorn. And the word and his glance fell on her like a blow.
"As is your will, Lord Praetorian,"
said Kazim Aleph I at last. Out of the corner of her eye, Su Kassen saw the Khan flick a look at Sanguinius. The angel's face remained impassive. Rogel Dorn came forwards, eyes moving from the Magos to Su Kassen.
"The initial battle data indicates that your projections were incorrect, Admiral."
She nodded and opened her mouth to reply.
"They were inaccurate by a factor of at least 30%,
cut in Kazim Aleph I.
"Maybe more. We cannot yet be precise, of course, but if the core data is correct, the enemy has brought a force numbering many thousands of vessels from the Immaterium."
"Thank you for your clarification, Major Emissary," said Dorn.
Su Kassen almost flinched at the ice in the words. Kazim Aleph I seemed oblivious to it.
"I am charged by the Fabricator General to aid your command in addition to representing the positions of Mars. I am..."
He paused as cogs turned and buzzed.
"Pleased that my function is of utility to you, Lord Praetorian."
Su Kassen thought she heard Malkador stifle a cough that might have been a laugh. For a giddy moment she found herself almost wanting to smile herself, and then clamped down on the feeling. It was tension, and the truth of what was happening finding a way of bleeding out, of breaking the silence. She wondered for a second if somewhere out there, under the blanket drone of alert sirens, there were people laughing as they felt the seconds tick by and future come closer. It was Sanguinius who broke the silence, walking forwards and raising a hand to dip his fingers into a turning sphere of light.
"It will be Uranus next," he said. "And if the attack is not already underway, it will be soon."
Su Kassen let out a breath she had not realized she was holding. Around her, she felt the command staff relax and refocus.
That had been deliberate, she thought. With but a few words, the angel had bent them all in a direction of his choosing.
"A signal relay to the outer spheres is still clear, Lord," said Su Kersen. "But there has been no word from Lord Halbracht at Uranus yet."
"You are still sure this is the path?" asked the Khan.
He had held back close to the doors, and apart from his glance at Sanguinius, he had remained utterly still. There was something in that stillness that was like the flash of lightning frozen in the eye.
"There are other ways. Horus could be scattering his might out in the depths beyond, and then circle them, closing from all sides, strangling us as he cuts us."
Dorn looked at the Khan.
"This is Horus. Do you still think he will be anything but himself?"
"He is not himself," said Sanguinius without turning from where the hololight played over his hand. Su Kersen felt the tension snap back into place in the room. She felt as though she and the rest of her staff had intruded on a conversation that these demigods had brought with them. "You have not seen him, Rogel," continued Sanguinius. "You have not seen the face of what has taken our brother."
"He may have changed," growled Dorn,
now as still as the Khan, the low light of the displays setting his face in cold lines and hollows of night.
"But the constraints he faces have not. Time. He does not have time. Gilliman breathes at his back. Horus has to come for us with everything he has as quickly as he can, or he will have nothing."
Dorn shook his head, a smile that was a ghost passing across his face.
"Besides, it is not his way."
The silence flowed back in.
"So we let him take the gates," said the Khan, his voice soft but edged. "We wall ourselves up and wait, and hope that those walls will prove strong enough?"
Dorn did not answer, his gaze locked with his brother's.
"We hold every wall, then we make them pay in time and blood for every step forwards."
"Just so," said Sanguinius, blurring his hand and gaze from the hollow display and turning to look at his siblings. "And a price in blood it shall be." Malkador's staff struck the floor. The blow was not powerful, but Su Kersen felt the air leave her lungs.
"There,"
he said, looking around. His eyes bright and hard. Everyone in the chamber, Primarch and human alike, was looking at him. Su Kersen watched a sad smile form on his face.
"You see, peace is possible, if only for a moment, and amongst ourselves."
The Khan laughed, and the frozen tension in the chamber vanished.
"Quite so, quite so. We forget our place and company."
The Primarch of the Fifth Legion unfolded from his stillness and came forwards, his movements fluid and relaxed. He circled the display, glancing up at it and around.
"This is fine work."
He looked at Su Kersen and nodded.
"Your cadre is to be commended, Admiral."
She bowed her head. For a second, she had felt as though the Khan had looked right through her. Beside her, apparently oblivious to what had been occurring, Kazim Aleph One glanced up from where he had been fidgeting through the raw data screed.
"The customary astropathic communications from across the system are absent," he said.
His eye lenses rotated in a way that created the distinct impression of a frown.
"At this time, and given the delay in other signals, delays inherent in the distances involved, it would be most advisable to make use of telepathic methods of communication. Also, the astropath's ability to sense warp displacement would be a significant advantage."
He paused, looking up at the Primarchs and command staff as though just seeing them.
"Do you not concur?"
"There will be no astro-telepathic messages from inside or outside the system, Majos Emissary," said Malkador, his voice low and edged by a weariness. "Nor any warning of more ships or fleets exiting the Immaterium."
"Why is that?"
asked the Magos. Nalkador closed his eyes, and Su-Kassen saw him shift his weight to his staff.
"Because all around us, the warp is howling."
Battle Barge Monarch of Fire, Trans-Uranic Gulf. Clouds of dust filled the Elysian Gate. An open volume of space 3,000 kilometers across, it glittered with folds of fine particles. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of years of void ships translating to the warp at this point had seeded it with drifts of the soft grey matter that formed in the wake of a closing breach. The Jovian clans and the navigator houses had a name for it. Siren ash, they called it. There were tales, they said, of prospectors who had tried to harvest the dust and could desire nothing else once they'd touched it. True or not, the dust remained, slowly coiling through the volume of the Elysian Gate like smoke caught in a glass orb. The gate had always been guarded. Things had come out of it during old night, things that the Uranus habitats remembered in tales of star vampires and iron men. They had built the first fortresses around the gate, watching it with guns and warriors. These stations were called the Eyes of the Old God, and they had kept their vigil as the rest of the solar system slid into the depths of the Age of Strife. Then the Great Crusade had risen from old Earth and brought the Uranus habitats and moons into the nascent Imperium. The watchful stations had grown, their hereditary warrior clans augmented by Martian weaponry. Ships had begun to pass through the gate into the Immaterium, and others had returned. The navigator houses re-established their fiefs amongst Uranus's 27 moons, and the volume of space between the gas giant and the Elysian Gate had become an ever-glittering stream of light as ships looped from the warp to the profusion of orbiting habitats and void stations. Horus's war had changed that. The flow of ships had become a sullen trickle, and the stations keeping the long watch had bloated with fresh armour and weaponry. Every foothold of humanity that could mount a macro cannon or host a fighter squadron had found itself made a fortress. Amongst this, facing the dark of the Elysian Gate, the ships of the Second Sphere hung motionless, crenellated and beweaponed in the glittering abyss. In the gate, the dust moved. A slow swirl gathered and coiled in on itself. Clouds hundreds of kilometers across flowed and folded. The dust began to spark. Tiny worms of lightning flicked between grey motes. The clouds began to glow, now green, now bruised violet, now bloodied ivory. The waiting fleets of warships lit their drives. In their sanctums, astropaths began to weep. In the habitats and stations, the low howl of warning sirens woke millions from dreams of shadows swallowing the sun. On the bridge of the Monarch of Fire, Lord Castellan Halbrecht, commander of the Second Sphere of Sol's defences, watched the reports blur across his sight as the helm of his Terminator armour locked in place.
"Fleet and defence-wide transmission," he said,
the rich accent of the Nordafric conclaves waiting his words. He saw the thousands of units under his command come to readiness in his helm display. The echoes of 100 warships' acknowledgements and salutes whispered across the vox. He breathed out and spoke.
"For the light of Sol and the earth of terror we stand. For the oaths we made, we stand. For the blood in our veins, we stand."
He heard it then, growing in the air outside his armour, as the hundreds of crew on the Monarch of Fire's bridge took up the words.
"For the stones laid by our ancestors, we stand."
And now the words were echoing across the vox, overlapping from thousands of mouths.
"For the days that have passed, and the days that shall come, we stand."
The swirl of dust in the sphere of the gate was moving faster, the light growing brighter.
"For the living, and the honour of the dead, we stand."
Shapes formed in the glare, blinking into sight like shadows cast by the flash of lightning.
The inner ring of gun platforms around the gate began to fire. Hundreds of shells blazed into the flashing dust. Some exploded, some vanished. The multicoloured swirl contracted. The gun platforms kept firing. Then the dust and light burst outwards. A split opened at the gate's centre, black beyond night. Across the gulf of the vacuum, the humans on the nearest gun platforms flinched as an ululating scream filled their ears. The dark hole flexed, its edges growing like a tear pulled wide in ragged fabric. The fire from the gun platforms was a deluge now. Shells tumbled into the spreading breach. Those that exploded burst like water as they touched the warp. A trio of shapes appeared in the dark. Bloated and monstrous, they pushed into reality. They had been macro transporters once, made to shift the output of worlds across the galaxy. Each was bigger than even the largest warships. Slabs of raw iron had been welded to their flanks, and clusters of void shield generators blistered their skin like boils. They had borne other names in their former ponderous lives, but the will of Perturabo had remade them, and had given them new titles to bear. Alecto, Megera, and Tilfusia were their names, and they had been reborn to die in the first moments of this assault. The second cordon of defences opened fire. Long-range turbo lasers burned 100-metre-wide channels through the blazing dust in the gate. The Alecto, Megera, and Tilfusia pushed onwards, molten metal weeping from their prows, their void shields lit. Fresh storms of lightning blazed through the dust clouds as ether-charged siren dust kissed the forming skins of energy. The deluge of fire began to find its mark as the three huge ships shot forwards. The plasma reactors from hundreds of half-dead machines filled the trio's decks and holds. They lit one after another. Power poured into engines and shields. Volleys of macro shells slammed into them as they shot out in different directions. Plasma conduits inside their guts began to rupture. Reactor containment began to fail, and thousands of the servitor crew died as their flesh cooked. Shells and lasfire crumpled shields and bit into iron skin. Fire chewed at them like rain into blocks of salt. It did not matter, though. They had not been made to live. In another age, back when Terra had oceans, such vessels were called fireships, crude mechanisms of horror and destruction in a time of primitive explosives and wooden vessels. On the defence platforms, the gunnery officers saw what was about to happen as the three ships hurtled closer towards the first line of defences. They did everything they could to prevent it. Macro cannon fire tore savagely into the prow plating of the Tilfusia as her shields collapsed. A chunk of smelted iron the size of a hab block peeled back, tumbling away as lance fire reached inside the first wound and burned into the huge ship's bones. The Tilfusia erupted in flame and light. The blast wave reached back to the warp gate, staining the dust cloud orange. 20 gun platforms vanished, their deaths marked by blinks of light within the blaze as their magazines cooked off. It was only as the defenders' auspects and targeting systems went dark that the true spite of the ironclad vessel's makers became clear. Laced into the heart of the Tilfusia and her sisters were machines looted from dead forge worlds. Half wreckage, their spirits violated and rebound by the priests of the new Mechanicum, these engines had once been wonders of lost arts of communication. Now they were instruments of cacophony. Waves of wild electromagnetic distortion, scrap code and haywire radiation ripped out with the Tilfusia's death fire. The distortion wave scratched its way into systems, darkened signal receivers, and sent gunnery servitors into feedback convulsions. The void fortresses and weapon platforms fired with everything they had. Half-blinded, they clawed burning holes in the hulls of the remaining sisters. It was not enough. The Alecto detonated as she breached the inner lines of defences around the gate. The Megera exploded minutes later. Weapon platforms the size of Manufactoria became shrapnel sprayed out into the dark. A blinding fog of fire and exotic radiation swallowed the gate, cloaking it in brightness. Halbrecht had held his ships back, but loosed his first battle groups now. These were monitor ships, blunt craft of raw firepower and armour. Crewed by humans pressed from the solar privateer clans, they knew the business of killing. They cut down channels between the fortresses and platforms. Gun batteries had fallen silent as their auspexes fogged. Torpedoes were shot blind into the fire-cloaked heart of the gate. For a moment, thousands of strands of light streaked the dark. Within the cloak of fire and radiation surrounding the gate, 8 main force-class battleships, translated into reality, guns primed. Each had been selected for their mass, armour, and the discipline of their crews. They were all ships bound to the Iron Warriors, and crewed by officers who had failed the 4th Legion before. That failure had earned them the honour of crossing this breach first. Forgiveness awaited those that survived, and the release of death those that proved weak. The guns of the 8 were discharging even as they arrived. Nova cannons ran down the spines of 4, and they began to fire blind. The squadrons of monitor craft responded with every weapon that could find a target. The Nova shells hit first. Each one was over 50 metres in diameter, and longer than some of the smaller warships in the battlesphere. Accelerated to within a breath of the speed of light, each carried a ship-killing payload. Spheres of exotic energy and primal destruction burst into being. Some caught gun platforms and void stations and tore their shields and armour from them. Graviton and haywire torpedoes struck the defences next, seeking out mass and reactor signatures. Sensor arrays shorted. Crushing gravity fields yanked void bastions out of alignment and cracked the shells of the monitor ships. The torpedoes fired by the defenders cut into the battlesphere. A cluster of 20 slammed into one of the 8 vanguard ships and swallowed its flank and spine in a stuttering blaze. The ship listed, plunging downwards as it died. Burning atmosphere vented from its wounds in vast streams. On the bridge of the Monarch of Fire, Halbrecht watched the first minutes unfold. This would not be a swift battle, but these moments would be crucial. The enemy had to race to establish a foothold in reality, a tipping point where the number of their ships outstripped the rate at which the defenders could kill them. So far, the odds of them succeeding were finely balanced. "Lord Halbrecht, something larger is coming through," called one of the sensor officers. "It casts a shadow even through the distortion." A shape pushed through the firelit dust and haze. At first it looked like a pitted asteroid or a wreck. Then the bulk behind its prow burst through the swirl. The dead of millennia of war amongst the stars were its mass. Mangled carcasses of starships, asteroids, towers and broken star fortresses, all crushed together by the immaterium. It was a macro-agglomeration of debris and dead things secreted by storm tides, a pearl of sorrow, a space hulk. The new Mechanicum had dragged it from the tides of the warp and remade it. Launch bays had been cut into its mass, reactors lit in its heart, and shield generators bound to its surface. Pushing and hauling it through the warp had cost a dozen ships, and once pushed back into reality, it would never move again. That, though, was not its purpose. The size of one of Uranus's moons, it was made to be a besieger's redoubt at the gate of a greater fortress. Daughter of Woe, it had been named. The ships that had already exited the immaterium slewed aside as the hulk grew and grew. Its bulk was breaking through the cloud on all sides of the gate now. 100-kilometre arcs of warp lightning writhed from the tearing edge of the vast hole it was boring in space. The dust of the Elysian Gate streamed down its face like water falling from a leviathan breaking from the depths of a dark sea. The wreckage of already dead ships impacted on its surface. Torpedoes and battery fire slammed into it. Chunks of rock and metal tore from it, and it kept coming. Assault craft began to launch from it in clouds. Small frigates that had made the journey bound to its skin broke their tethers and slid into the void. Lord Castellan Halbrecht watched as the Daughter of Woe lit with fire from the rings of defences. This had not been anticipated, but it changed little. His orders and oaths still stood. The only question was how much they could make the enemy pay, and the price his forces paid in turn.
"Light our guns," he said.
And the monarch of fire shook to his order. Battle Barge War Oath, Supra Solar Gulf. The herald ship surfaced from the night. Bit by bit her shape grew, spear, blade, prow, and gun-serrated flanks emerging from a lightless ocean. Shadows fumed from her substance like black ink dropped into water. The sun shone beyond her armoured bows. She had been birthed in the light of that sun, but had not seen its light in over a century. The Emperor himself had named her War Oath, and she still bore that name. But like the legion that commanded her now, time had remade her. Ghost light clung to her turrets and pooled in the scars that marked her flanks. The marks of the Imperial fists had long been removed, and the wounds done to her at the Battle of Fal were now repaired, but signs of her one-time masters still lived in her bones. Ezekiel Abaddon looked out at the void light through the armour-glass dome of the War Oath's observatory. Perched atop a slender tower on the ship's command castle, its purpose had been to watch and chart the stars. A great stack of brass machinery hung from the dome's apex, its lenses, dials and mirrors filmed with dust. Abaddon doubted that anyone had ever used the instruments. What need was there for such poetic flourishes on a warship equipped with sensors and long-range auspex? A Neverborn hissed in his ears as it dissolved from the bones of the ship. A spectre with orb eyes and a smile of needle teeth ran the tip of its claw down the observatory's dome. It grinned. Abaddon met its gaze as it faded to nothing. The bright, distant jewel of Sol glowed through the fading shadow of its mouth. He caught a glimmer at the edge of his eyes, glanced around and saw the image of the sun shining from an octagonal silver mirror set at the centre of the chamber's floor. He froze, eyes fixed on the circle of light floating beneath the surface of the dusty silver.
"The gods bless us and bring us to the light of truth," said Zardu Leak, from where he knelt on the stone floor.
Candles of human tallow burned with rainbow-streaked flames around him. 8 heaps of ash and blackened bone lay around the word-bearer. They had been chosen from amongst Leak's mortal flock, and had burned where they knelt as the war oath translated from the warp into reality. None of them had made a sound as they were engulfed. That silence had clenched the muscles along Abaddon's jaw. Part of him had thought of ordering the Justerian Terminators standing at the edge of the room to open fire and reduce the word-bearers and their foul sacrifice to pulped meat and shredded armour. Witch frost cracked from Leak's armour as he rose. The 2 red-armoured warriors that had stood guard over his vigil bowed their heads. Leak extended his hand, and his staff coalesced into being in his grasp. Abaddon looked into the rows of glowing eyes running down the cheeks of Leak's horned mask.
"It is done,"
he asked. Leak nodded.
"By the will of the 4 and the 8-fold star."
Abaddon felt his lips pulled back from his teeth.
"You do not have faith in the gods?"
"I have faith in our war master,"
growled Abaddon, and opened a vox link to the ship's command echelon.
"Report readiness condition."
Static chopped through the replies. He listened, his mind folding each report into a precise map of the ship's current strength and capability. Satisfactory. If needed, they could fight and kill now. The need was unlikely, if all had gone as it should, but you always drew a blade before stepping into the dark. The fingers of his right hand twitched, curling for an instant before he stilled them. For a second, he had felt the ghost of his false father's knife bite into his forearm as he squeezed.
"You are a fool, boy."
He could see the eyes above the blood-stained teeth, could feel his fingers digging into the neck beneath them.
"It will slip through your fingers."
"You were not born under that light, were you?" asked Leak.
Abaddon blinked. The word-bearer had come to stand next to him in front of the view of the sun.
but in a sense I suppose we all were. This is our cradle, is it not, brother?
The Lunar Genewright rose, chromed and cold, its six-bladed limbs opening above its naked flesh in a spider embrace.
You will be born anew, it had whispered as it began to cut. Moonwrought and blooded. You are not my brother, priest, said Abaddon.
And the threat in the words was enough to bring Laiac's bodyguards forwards, their blades drawing, cracks of fire spreading over their armour. Abaddon looked at them, his eyes glittering above a cold smile. Laiac stilled them with a twitch of his head. The pair paused and nodded once before stepping back. A blurt of data filled the vox for a second. Abaddon listened and then cut the link.
The Thousand Suns ship translated successfully.
It did, and we are here,
said a voice that rolled in Abaddon's skull. His teeth clamped shut as he shrugged the telepathic communication away. An image unfolded in the air, translucent and shimmering, crimson armour edged in ivory. The eyes set in the smooth face shone with a cold blue light. Arzek Ahriman nodded once to Abaddon and walked closer, his ghost image trailing light and frost in the air. Laiac's bodyguards had begun to draw their blades once more. Ahriman's image turned to look at them. They met his gaze. The light of their eye lenses had begun to burn red, and yellow embers were trickling from the splits that had opened in their armour. Ahriman tilted his head. Ice ran across the floor.
"Tell the warlock to muzzle his dogs," he sent, without moving his lips.
The eyes in Laiac's mask were glowing, and blood was seeping from between its metal fangs. A smell of sulphur and burnt sugar mingled with ozone. Abaddon glanced at where the four Justerin stood at the edge of the chamber. The glance held them in place.
"Cease," growled Abaddon.
Laiac looked at the image of Ahriman for a second, and then turned away. His two bodyguards slid their blades back into their sheaths. The splits closed in their armour. The light in their eyes dimmed. Ahriman turned and glided towards the viewport. An instinct to flinch away from the ghost figure tugged at Abaddon's muscles. He held still, eyes following the Thousand Suns librarian, as he looked out at the view of terror beyond the dagger point of the ship's prow.
Home.
Ahriman's mouth did not move, but the shadows of his brow furrowed.
What creatures are we that come from the night to hearth and home and find only strangers on the threshold?
Laiac made a sound that might have been a hiss of laughter.
Kylik of Neuropolis, said Abaddon, from the Songs of Passing. And what stranger beasts do the eyes of fathers see who after long years stand by open doors and wait?
Ahriman turned to look at him. The light of the stars glimmered through the gauzy image of his frown. He raised an eyebrow.
We're warriors, not barbarians, said Abaddon.
Then he nodded at the distant sun.
Where's the rest of the armada?
Watch,
said Ahriman. Sheets of aurora light formed in the night beyond, flowing and curling across the dark. The light of the sun and the stars blurred as it fell through the curtains of colour, sliding out of place until it seemed that the heavens had been twisted into a new position. Shadows formed in the folds of light, jagged silhouettes like the shards of broken spears. Millions had died to make this possible. Tens of thousands had been bled into offering vats or been jettisoned from hangar bays into the warp. Most had died with pleas for mercy on their lips. Some had spoken prayers of thanks to the gods. Slaves taken from conquered worlds, helots from the deep decks of the ships, even some chosen from amongst the soldiery that had sworn loyalty to Horus, all had died, their blood and souls poured into nothing to make this possible. The powers that Horus had bound to his cause. And now they'd slid them back into being, well past the Mandeville point of the solar system, that invisible barrier created by a star's gravity, past which it was unsafe to translate ships to and from the warp. There had been a price, of course. A price and a limit.
The price had been paid in blood, and the limit was that for all the Neverborn could bend the rules to place these ships deep within the solar sphere, they could not violate them utterly. They had not been able to return the Warmaster's ships directly into Terran orbit. Not yet. But what the blood and death had bought was what some would have called a miracle, even so. The jagged shadows in the coiling light faded momentarily. A fork of green lightning whipped across the void, branching across thousands of kilometers. The light froze for an instant. A shiver ran across Abaddon's skin under his armor. His gaze was locked on the scene beyond the glass. He felt his twin hearts each beat once. The frozen flash of lightning exploded. He blinked. Ships filled the void around the War Oath, tens of thousands of vast dark metal shapes fuming pale smoke. The stars swirled, and the aurora light folded over and over, caressing their hulls as thousands of vessels shivered into full reality. Sons of Horus, word-bearers, and the new Mechanicum, enough to conquer star clusters, all hanging above the sun like daggers. Abaddon watched the ships settle, and the ghost light fade from their hulls. Behind him, the image of Ahriman faded too. A moment later, he heard the door release, and Laiac and his bodyguards withdraw. Abaddon turned when he heard the doors reseal. He inhaled, bringing emotion to a point of focus. He loathed how they had come here. He loathed more the weakness of his own legion, implied by the aid given by the thousand suns and word-bearers to make this impossibility a reality. But here and now, his loathing did not matter. All that mattered was the weapon that his father, his war master, had placed in his hand. He heard his oath then, not the oath he had knelt and given at the foot of Horus's throne, but one given long ago, beneath the light of the sun that waited for him at the end of this path.
"Will you serve me, Abaddon?" Horus had asked, the coin held out in his open palm.
"I will,"
he had replied, and taken the coin.
"All ships,"
he said, hearing his voice echo as it reached across the void through the vox. "By my word, and the word of the War Master, the blade falls."
One by one, the ships lit their engines and slid down towards the waiting sun.